You fought in the Clone Wars?
Yes. I was once a Jedi Knight, the same as your father. For over 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic. Before the Dark Times.
Protocol 66 must not be discovered by the Jedi.
Yes, Lord Tyrannus.
You must face the gravest of journeys tomorrow, Bond.
The ancient homeworld of the Sith.
You're listening to Coffee with Kenobi.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
Ah, very good.
Welcome to A Cup of the Clone Wars. Here are your hosts, Dan Sisa and Corey Clapp.
Hi, this is Eric Geller from the Forcecast, and you're listening to Coffee with Kenobi with Dan Zaire and Corey Clapp. This is the podcast you're looking for.
Welcome to A Cup of Clone Wars, where Coffee with Kenobi examines Star Wars The Clone Wars through a critical lens. On our inaugural show, we will be discussing the first four episodes of Season 6, the Order 66 arc. Joining us to start this exciting new series on Coffee with Kenobi is Eric Geller of The Forcecast and TheForce.net. Eric is a podcasting icon whose analysis and reviews of The Clone Wars are must-experience events for Star Wars fans. Whether Eric is leading a Clone Wars roundtable on The Forcecast or writing reviews on TheForce.net, you don't want to miss his insights and opinions. We are honored to have a cup of coffee and to discuss the first arc of Season 6. Welcome, Eric. As we had talked about before the show, we've been wanting to review Season 6 of The Clone Wars for a while. Now everybody's all caught up and we're ready to roll. And Eric was kind enough to have me on recently to talk about Destiny, the penultimate episode in Season 6. So we're just going to kind of look at these, as we talked about before, Corey. We're going to look at these as arcs, not as individual episodes, because The Forcecast has already done that. And if our listeners have not already done so, please go to The Forcecast and check out the Clone Wars Roundtables, because they go through each episode and they are excellent. So we're just going to kind of take some themes and ideas and look at it Coffee with Kenobi style. And I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out there to you two gentlemen. What are your overall opinions of this actual arc? And Eric, why don't we just start with you?
Wow, overall, you know, I thought this was one of the strongest arcs in the series, because it's called The Clone Wars, but up until now, there have only been a couple of episodes where we've really dug into what it means to be a clone. And so I thought this was a phenomenal arc as far as establishing their relationships, going to all these different places emotionally, but also sort of physically. You know, we see the clone bar toward the end of the story arc. And then, you know, sort of emotionally, the range is just as big as far as the different places they go, from the beginning when you have this sort of this solid brotherhood and this trust, to the end where, of course, you see the way that Five sort of unravels. It was a great journey in that sense, but it was also just the treatment of the clones and how they see themselves and how they start to question things when the circumstances are right. I thought it was really great.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And I also think when I first started the whole series itself, the clones I thought were kind of throwaway characters. They kind of grew on me after a while. And this arc really kind of cemented that idea of brotherhood, of combat and arms, really kind of taking it to a different level where, you know, we got to, like, say, see it through their eyes and see what they had to deal with and how they're really a group of friends and brothers and how they get along. And, of course, it does, you know, dip into the films themselves too, some of those big, strong secrets that are out there and looking to explore that. I love that. So I think, like you said, it was a really strong arc.
And I agree with you, Eric, and you too, Corey, that the fact that this is one of the strongest overall arcs in the, not just the season, but the entire series, because it takes everything about the Clone Wars. You can tell that Dave Filoni and crew have been building and building. So this is almost like the climax of the Clone Wars, really, because everything is coming to a head. We get these insights into Order 66. We really see even more of the cementing of the clones and kind of what makes them tick. And were either of you surprised, or were you, I've heard some mixed reviews online. I'm sure you both have as well, as far as getting a little bit of more information about Order 66 and why that comes about. Do you think this arc added to that or kind of muddied the waters a little bit?
We've definitely heard a lot of mixed opinions, even just on our Clone Wars roundtable about that, as far as does it cheapen things or does it make things more compelling? I came down ultimately on the side of it makes things more compelling, in the sense that this whole journey has been about identity and independence, for the clones. I'm saying, you know, as far as what can they do on their own, in what ways are they limited by being part of this army? I mean, they were grown for this purpose, and to see that, to see us, you know, sort of get distance from that idea of them being bred to fight over the course of this war, as we see them in different ways, to see that them really expand as individuals, and you see the haircuts and the voices. I mean, the Clone Wars consciously put it right in our face that they were people too. And so I think it's sort of, it makes it really nicely tragic. It's a compelling dramatic moment when you think about the fact, and the Clone Wars has now established this as what seems to be a fact, that it was programmed the whole time, that it was not, you know, Palpatine, you know, saying, remember all those things that happened during the war? Well, it's finally come true, and sort of convincing them, you know, at that moment of Order 66. It really was just a switch was thrown to make them, you know, biochemically react. I think that makes it more tragic, and I think the purpose really of the latter part of the prequel trilogy to me is tragedy. It is to show the unwinding of things and the erosion of things. And one of the ways that the Clone Wars sort of plays on that here, to me anyway, is it erodes this sense of individuality. It brings us back to this stark reality that they are programmed.
Well, and Nala Say even specifically, she seems to feel threatened, that the clones start to think, what does she say? She says they think more creatively now, more critically.
She's worried about that from the Jedi.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the exact quote here. She says they're starting to do more creative thinking, which is, it really reminded me of World War II and this idea of, you know, burning books and taking away individuality, like you had mentioned, Eric, and this idea that that can be a threat to the established order of how, now let's say in the Kaminoans, how they look at things. I remember you guys were kind of wondering, was it Kaminoans, Kaminians?
I always said Kaminoans, but I sometimes catch myself saying Kaminoans.
Yeah, I think that's what Nala says, is Kaminoans. But I found it interesting too. The fortune cookie. The very first thing we see is the truth about yourself is always the hardest to accept. And I found that quote to be quite challenging, because is it truth? Is there really a lot of truth going on in this? You know, when the clones turn, when the chip activates or deactivates, or however you want to look at it, is that truth when you are killing something or a Jedi, when you're killing a Jedi and you have no control over that? Is that really truth?
I always saw it as the truth of what they were supposed to be, right? And fighting that truth was sort of Fives' goal at the end. But ultimately, what he had to realize was that he had been set up for this purpose.
Well, I can't help but think of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You know, the search for it's if you want truth, you have to go down. He measures truths and facts and how that kind of goes. And yet, truthfully, that is why it happens. And before this episode, I always kind of assumed that because of what happens with Ahsoka, that over time the clones become more and more disgruntled, and there was something major that happened that kind of pushed them over the edge. And now we see, in fact, that there is real tragedy, almost like King Lear tragedy, just this fall from grace of this strong, proud person or people in the case of the clones. They're extremely tragic, maybe as much as anything that Anakin Skywalker experiences, because they're turning on their friends, their comrades, people they incredibly respect, and it just gets really, really ugly. Corey, how does this thing kind of affect Order 66 for you?
Well, like you guys mentioned, it kind of brings more details in, as long as, you know, this whole Order 66 and how it kind of came to be. I kind of relate it to like an 80s spy film. Kind of, he's going around doing this kind of secret stuff. And
The Fugitive.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really has that vibe for me, but also it kind of shows, like you said, it fleshes out the clones themselves as characters and individuals. And I always kind of thought that, like, they always keep bringing up this mission they have, these nightmares they're having and things like that. And I think that it's almost like they all kind of understand what this quote-unquote nightmare mission is, and they all, like, and it seems like Fives comes to the realization even at the end there that he kind of like realizes, oh, the mission, you know, I've done my mission. And like we always think the clones are programmed to carry out orders, whether they like it or not. And throughout the whole Clone Wars, we see them kind of almost, you know, fighting that urge a little bit here and there as they go along with their missions and do things. And they're almost like fighting the orders they're supposed to do. And, you know, when it comes down to it, obviously we see that Fives is, you know, he's fighting that so that, you know, he can find out what the secret is. And he's rushing around to find that and obviously finds out. We don't know what, you know, he ultimately knows. I mean, he knows somewhat, I think, the basis of everything. But
well, he seems to be right on the pulse of what's going on. That's just right. How I think it. And the quote that you're looking for is, good soldiers follow orders. I know that on the Forcecast, you guys talked about that a lot. But I'm interested in, how do we view the clones? How do you two view the clones? Do you think that they have souls? And how does this whole entire thing flesh them out?
Interesting. I think it's hard to say, I think, because a clone is a copy. I mean, do you copy a physical piece or a mental piece? You'd think it'd be of both.
Well, they are individualized, but for them, the individuality is based on their names and a haircut. Right. And we don't get enough. We have a very, very, very small sample size of what they are like and their different personalities. And they do seem to have different personalities. And it is challenging because they all sound the same. They all look the same. Eric, do clones have souls?
I'm not really sure. I do think that the their differing personalities, at least from the ones that we've seen, probably when they're faced with the same stimuli and the same circumstances, those personalities do send them on divergent paths, at least slightly divergent. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that they begin to develop identities outside of their primary existence as soldiers in this army because, you know, for whatever reason. And, you know, it actually, the more I think about it, the more it's inevitable. You're sending them out. They're the same from the beginning, but they go on different missions to different places. They face different natives. They face different threats. Those things are going to shape them almost inevitably in divergent ways. And so it's hard for me to imagine them not developing different, you know, resentments. Maybe some of them start to get, you know, develop certain bigotries based on the way that they interacted with people on their first command, and that sort of shapes them. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens, you know, unless they're battle droids and there's that degree of uniformity, they are going to develop personalities and traits that will set them apart from each other.
Well, and did you notice, I found this rather startling, and I know dramatically why this happened, but I think you could take it a step further. When Tup actually, you know, commits this heinous act, you know, and he murders Tiplar, he takes his mask off to commit this atrocity. Now, in Order 66 in Revenge of the Sith, I don't remember that going on. I'm curious as to why he chose to do that. Well, I chose. That's an interesting word. No choice really there. But he takes off his lid to do that. Why do you think he would do that? I think dramatically.
Well, yeah. I think first of all, they're showing his face to give him humanity, but I also think that he's fighting something that he needs to, you know, break free from, and he can't fight it. I mean, he has to physically remove himself in a sense, his helmet, but he's fighting it.
But then, does he take off the idea of being a clone and fighting for the Jedi, and just becomes an individual at that point? I mean, clearly, again, he's not an individual. He doesn't get to choose. That has been taken away from him temporarily. But I think that's very powerful that he does that. I mean, how many times have we seen studies of cosplay and the power of masks and what that does to you?
I always saw it as a trance kind of thing. Like, he's looking at Tiplar, and he's not really sure what he's doing. He's just sort of confused, and maybe part of that is he's wondering if the helmet is contributing to his sort of disorientation, and he's taking it off as if to sort of maybe clear up whatever he's perceiving. And of course, it's not related to the helmet, but maybe he thinks it is at first because he has no idea what else it could be.
And I just watched it the other day, but does he take off the mask and then go into the trance, or does he go into the trance first? I thought he went into the trance first.
I think it was first, yeah.
I think so too.
Yeah, he's in the trance, and then when he turns the corner and he's looking at Tiplar, that's when they have that shot of over his shoulder looking at her, and then he takes it off and he's already in the trance, but he seems confused. Mm-hmm. Like he's not committed to his action yet. He's still trying to figure out what's going on. And that's when he starts to say, you know, Jedi and good soldiers follow orders.
And that is and I like what you wrote in your review about how chilling that is and how powerful it is that they don't actually show the laser blast commit the act, but you can very much clearly see what's going on there. I'm a little bit concerned. I don't know if concerned is the right word. That's probably an overstatement, but Tipley's reaction to all of this. I grant you that this is not her story. This is not her arc. And at one point, she has some serious menace on her face, and she uses the force to throw Tup across the room. But she seems extremely laid back for someone who just watched her presumably twin sister assassinated right in front of her. That really bothered me.
Huh. I noticed that too a little bit, that she wasn't as sorrowful as she could have been. But I think she was more frustrated about the whole idea too. I mean, it seemed like everybody in the whole arc was confused of what's going on as far as trying coming to grips of what the actions that had taken place.
She just seemed very laid back a little too soon. And maybe it's just because that's the nature of the program and it's hard to get into that kind of thing. But Eric, did that rub you the wrong way at all?
You know, thinking back on it, it was a bit surprising. I guess you could say that she was in shock.
And, I can see that.
You know, she was trying to, I mean, you know, this is one of those things where you said it really well. It's not her story. And I kind of wonder if maybe the camera were tilted slightly differently so it became her story, you would see her sort of in shock and using her experience and her training to contain herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we're not seeing anything because that's what she wants. But if it had been her story, maybe we would see it more internally as far as trying to sort of deal with it without, you know, without losing her composure.
That could be. And isn't it they say we were designed to withstand any stress? And then she says, I agree, we've been through a lot together. I believe it was her that said that. She certainly, I think shock does work for me as far as that goes. I thought it was fascinating real briefly. The zero gravity combat, which apparently we're going to see in Rebels as well, that brave yet futile attempt of that officer to get help. But it almost like what happens with him sort of encapsulates everything that happens to Fives throughout the entire four episodes, really, which I thought was beautifully done.
I also liked how they gave us a couple of minutes for this one person who doesn't really command a big, you know, influence on the story, but it was almost like they wanted to zoom in on one experience. And like you said, representative, and certainly in that sense, it benefits the story. But aside from that, it has its own merit as a sort of, let's pause, let's push everything else aside, and let's just deal with this to give you a sense of the kind of threat that the Republic is dealing with.
And then the entire scene where Anakin goes in and rescues with Rex and, you know, and Fives to go in there. I thought that was an incredibly beautifully animated sequence. You know, that's why he's the ARC trooper. I know you talked about that in your review, Eric. It shows that pride in a positive way. I found it fascinating. We don't go very much into Anakin in these four episodes, but he's very powerful, very un-Jedi-like with that interrogation droid. And I thought it was fascinating that he cuts off his arm and then he cuts off his head like Dooku. It was almost like a little bit of foreshadowing.
Oh, he's ruthless. Yeah. I mean, when he, you know, one of the things I found really interesting to watch is compare him when nobody that he sort of personally knows is threatened and when he's just on a mission, and then compare that to when somebody is either, you know, becomes, you know, is in danger or something happens that puts somebody out of commission and that sets him off. I mean, you see these triggers for him and the contrast of before and after somebody that he personally knows is threatened is a really interesting contrast to me.
Oh, I agree. And I've always said that it's the Clone Wars series that fleshed out the characters of Anakin and the clones and a lot of people from the prequel trilogy that made them more like flesh and blood, kind of gave a soul to them that the movies didn't always allow us to venture into, which I always found very much appreciative of Dave Filoni and company. So I want to look at the actual function of the inhibitor chip. When the Kaminoans, what do you think? The Kaminoans are accurate? Is Shaak Ti accurate? Or what truly do you think is going on? Because we don't quite know.
Yeah,
I mean, I've always seen it as the Kaminoans are telling the truth. It is to make them more compliant. But part of that, maybe a subroutine on that chip, is exactly what, you know, what Palpatine wants. I mean, what he's going to use eventually anyway.
I suppose so. And I mean, five is pretty much seems to be right on the money with it. But I think the thing that I kind of struggle with Nala say, that idea that you put it in because otherwise you'll be too aggressive, like Jango Fett. I don't remember Jango Fett being incredibly aggressive. I remember being very cold and calculating and Chuff, but I also saw him being very tender with Boba Fett and very calm through a lot of the parts when he wasn't actually in combat himself. So I found that to be far from a truth.
Yeah, I thought that the way that the Kameons played, it was kind of like they knew something but didn't know the whole deal. They were just kind of doing their job. But I mean, in the long run, it seems to open up a little bit towards their side. I always felt from the movies that they were kind of like this. Either they weren't taking sides, you know, as far as separatists mm-hmm. or Jedi or Republic.
Sure.
And I feel like they were kind of a nice little in between characters that were just trying to help out and just do business. You know, do their job and what they were supposed to do. And this really kind of made them look evil to me.
Well, I never thought of them as. I always thought of them as sort of neutral. If we're going to do
neutral
thing here with their idea, and we see more that they're a little more in cahoots with what, you know, Darth Tyrannus, we'll see that for Chad, what Count Dooku has in mind. But do you buy that, Eric, that whole idea that it makes him less aggressive because of Jango Fett?
No, and I think that's part of the, you know, clearly this is for the benefit of Shakti, is to give the Jedi who is on site a sense that this is necessary, that, you know, oh, you remember him and he was unpredictable. He was a shadowy character. Well, what other tendencies might he have had? Don't want those to get into the clones. So I agree. I don't think that was a realistic expectation from Jango that he would have that problem. I still do think that the chip was genuinely keeping them from being aggressive and headstrong. I mean, the Kaminoans, you can see they disdain that quality in the clones when they discover it. They root it out.
True.
So I think that was genuinely there. I don't think that they were actually concerned that it would come from Jango. I think it would just be one of those things where, look, we're putting them in situations where that tendency to go off on your own or to try something headstrong is very appealing. I mean, it's going to be pulling at them. And so we have to prevent that. But when we talk to the Jedi about it, we should try to bring up this character that they don't know too much about that might worry them, Jango Fett.
Good point. And I also kind of think that while they may be hardwired to be more willing to be obedient soldiers, they have enough of a free will seemingly that I don't see so much then there. I'm almost, even through the course of our conversation here, I'm almost kind of starting to think that the sole purpose of this inhibitor chip is only to activate Order 66 and has nothing to do with anything else as far as how the clones are existing.
Well, I mean, remember that some of the clones that we see behave the most sort of headstrongly, if that's not a word, but some of the clones who we see behave in the way that you would least expect if they were being inhibited are either ARC troopers or commanders or captains. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see rank and file behave that way. I mean, I'm thinking of the Krell ARC, for example. There's a lot of comments made about Krell that you wouldn't expect if they were all, you know, yes, sir, we'll follow orders. And so that's definitely there among rank and file. But I do wonder to what extent, right? I mean, they grumble. And so they're clearly aware of contradictions and worrisome things about Krell. But would they, you know, how much of that, if that conflict had gone on longer, how much of that, you know, unrest would we have seen, you know, bubble up? It bubbled up among some of them.
Sure.
And I think, again, I go back to they're shaped by the conflicts that they've fought in, by the campaigns they've served in. I can see an argument for this chip really having this purpose, but it may be being corroded, not technically speaking, but sort of effectively it has been worn away by their experiences and their prejudices and their beliefs. Maybe that is starting to overpower the design of the chip.
And you say that as far as the idea of the aggressive nature, the inhibitor concept of the chip?
Yeah, anything that the chip was supposed to, was designed to prevent, if in fact it does have that purpose, whether it's aggression or independent thinking or questioning, any of those things that you wouldn't want an army. You know, I think it's possible that the chip does have that purpose. It may just not be working as well as it did in the beginning of the war.
And is that at all disturbing, the notion that the Jedi are supposed to uphold this higher notion of good would employ someone who is essentially a mind slave that can't disobey because they are programmed that way. That's pretty twisted.
Well, and I think that's why the Jedi, as much as possible, try to break them out of that. I mean, the reason you want this instead of battle droids, even if you inhibit them or if you try to inhibit them, is that, you know, you're not going to inhibit them as much as the Separatists have to their battle droids. They are still going to think on their own and use the sort of human tendencies to some limited degree to be a better army. So that part is baked into the design. They did specifically want clones rather than droids. But after that, the Jedi take over and they say, you know, we're going to take it even further. You know, maybe they're trained to be docile and whatever, but we think they work best when they're thinking on their feet and when they're questioning things that they consider to be dicey. And so we want to give them that opportunity. Partly that may be pragmatic and partly it may be ideological. Well, we're uncomfortable with the idea of basically having human slaves. So we're going to try to make them as unslave-like as possible.
Because otherwise they're droids too.
Sure. Yeah.
So we're just going to jump around a little bit here, but Corey had an interesting theory about the chip and midichlorians. Corey, you want to go into that?
Yeah, sure. I kind of had an idea where they were kind of talking about the chip being made up of cells, and I talked about midichlorian counts and things like that. You know, it's interesting that does that have anything to do with the force related midichlorians as far as. You know, it was implanted by, the Sith in a sense. So is there some kind of aspect to it, the cells or midichlorians or something of the Force?
Are you saying that maybe they blind the Force in midichlorians because none of the Jedi, they seem to sense there's something weird going on, at least at this particular arc, but all the years that they're with the clones and nothing seems to pop up for them. But, I mean, the Force isn't really a spider sense.
No. I'm saying it's more of like midichlorians are trying to shape the balance of the Force in a way. Maybe this is part of it, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
I don't know. It was just kind of a thought that I had that it was – we've kind of talked about before, I think, to the fact that the Force is working, you know, for the Sith in a sense to balance things out, knowing – where in the long run it will go, and I think maybe this maybe might be part of it. Maybe not. I don't know.
Huh. I don't know. I think I disagree with you on that. What do you think, Eric?
You mean as far as are the midichlorians part of the inhibitor chip and sort of maybe blinding the Jedi to the effects of the chip?
Right. Yeah. I mean to basically use the Force is using the inhibitor chips as a vessel to, you know. Like I said, blind them to what's going on.
Oh. So like purposely sabotaging the Jedi Order?
Right.
What is in your coffee, mister?
Hey, I just thought about it. I thought that's interesting.
Yeah, so. No, it is interesting. I've always thought that the whole idea of ultimately bringing balance to the Force by the end of Return of the Jedi had more to do with the fact that Palpatine and the dark side were just too strong and two people essentially were overpowering the entire Order. So Luke had to come out and level things out and make a clean playing field. So, and maybe I'm thinking too much of Darth Plagueis now, which of course is no longer canon. Well, it was never canon, let's be honest. Even Steve Sansweet told us that. I think midichlorians, I'm more intrigued by the idea of the organic nature of them and supposedly this chip. And there isn't more awareness of the Jedi. And Eric, you mentioned beautifully in one of your reviews the idea that because of politics and not really knowing all of the answers, this is what makes things so incredible, Palpatine's machinations to do this in such a strategic way.
I mean, clearly he's taking advantage of an environment that could not be riper for what he's trying to do. You have these different layers of bureaucracy. I mean, to go a little bit ahead to a different arc where Yoda goes and talks to Valorum and finds out something that he didn't know was going on with his own Jedi Knights. I mean, there is so much that you wouldn't – if you heard about it, for example, that scene with Valorum, your response would be, "What? How can he not know about this? He's basically the leader of the Jedi Order." And that, I think, speaks to it's very difficult to control an organization that big, whether it's the Republic or the Jedi Order. And Palpatine exploits it both in his own organization and in Yoda's. And he takes advantage of the fact that it's very hard to be everywhere at all times, even if you're Mace Windu or Yoda. Mm-hmm. And he plays on just the right uncertainty. You know, this arc sort of ends with the Jedi questioning what it is to serve with these clones and whether they should continue to do it and how they message that out to the public or if they do that at all. So all these questions, which you wouldn't necessarily think are part of the core Star Wars mythology, you know, how do they discuss whether they're going to lead this army or not? It is very important because it speaks to the fear that they're grappling with internally, and also that is sort of tearing them apart from the outside. And of course, that is the dark side.
Yeah, it feeds that paranoia and that suspicion and that great fear. And you almost have to wonder, when you think about all the things that happened through the Clone Wars because of Palpatine, does he have a giant whiteboard somewhere, just like Greg Weisman does when he's planning out episodes of Rebels in his series? I mean, there are a lot of things you can't possibly believe that one person, even someone as powerful as Palpatine, I mean, clearly he's got a lot of good fortune. The dark side of the Force is clearly ebbing and flowing through him, but he's a guy that I think you could do an entire, not just an episode, but an entire podcast, like a series of podcasts on him, because what he does, that whole scene where he talks to Fives and he says, don't worry, I'll be protected because I've got my troopers here with me. Do you think that he told Fives the truth, or what do you think happened in that room? Talk about a short story that I want to read.
Yeah, I think part of me wants to say, yeah, he told him everything and just put him over the top and wanted that. He wanted to make him look crazy, obviously, and attack him. He wanted to be attacked. You know, that he's all about manipulation. So it's almost mm-hmm. like, well, I'll tell him, and eventually he'll just be killed, and that's the end result. But I also think, too, it's like, what else would he have told him? And the other troopers that are in there, how much do they know? I mean, I don't know. It's interesting.
I think it speaks to his utter confidence in his own plan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he doesn't tell Fives and then kill him on the spot just sort of for the sadistic pleasure of, okay, I told you, but now you're going to die. I mean, he lets him out. That's part of the plan, is to discredit him by letting him run and talk and seem crazy. He is so confident that no one will believe him. B, anybody who starts to possibly listen to him will start to think, you know, they'll have second thoughts when they see him. And you see that's true with Rex and Anakin. You know, Fives' composure, or his lack of composure, is what seals the deal for them as far as doubting him. So he is so confident that all those things will play together in the right way, in a way that benefits him. He doesn't have to be hands-on. And I think, you know, Dan, what you were saying, how can he possibly pull all this off, even if he has the dark side on his side? He also has his mastery of human, or I guess I should just say sentient emotions and sentient thought processes. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has mastered,
yeah.
Exactly. In a sense, he knows what strings to pull on and what dominoes to knock over, because he understands how other people, he can get inside other people's heads as far as, okay, Fives is standing here and he's just put this containment field around me and I'm Anakin. How am I going to react? He can game out how those kinds of people are going to respond in those kinds of situations instantly, right? He can imagine that mapped out across a whole web of people, and he tailors his small part to exactly what he needs to do.
Well, it's Machiavellian. He's the ultimate Sith. I mean, he's the ultimate bad guy. He's the ultimate villain. He's a terrorist. He's just all these things. Like, it's almost like if you made a little potion of all of the evil, powerful leaders in the history of the Earth, it's like he borrows a little bit from all of them. He's a very dangerous man. And I can't help but wonder, for the record, I think that he just pretty much laid it all out there and he said, and guess what? I'm going to get away with it too. And you're not going to be able to stop me. And I think that Fives flips out, as anyone would. And I like to kind of think that Palpatine flashes a little bit of Sith eyes at him. Who knows? That's just maybe just me being reading too much fan fiction, I guess. But what is it? How much do you think that reaction? I'm endlessly fascinated by this small little detail where Nala Se injects Fives in orders at the very beginning. You know, what are you doing? Don't drug me. Is she drugging him? Is she making him extra paranoid? And maybe someone has already talked about this in another podcast. Maybe it's been addressed already. But I want to know what in the heck he was injected with, and how did that impact that scene where Vader would eventually be born? Because did you
Part
notice that,
suspicion.
Corey?
Did yeah, it's the reconstruction chamber, isn't
you
it?
You got
it.
Oh, it sure is.
Oh, yeah.
It's even got the Imperial symbol on the floor.
Oh, I didn't see that. Yeah, I didn't know either.
The funny thing about that is I didn't even notice that in the movie. I saw a trivia video.
Yeah, me too.
That's I'm like, wait, what?
I know. Pretty clever. Anyway, what were you saying about this moment with Nalase and this injection?
Well, my guess was that she, I mean, obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, but my strong belief is that she has no, I mean, how could she have any idea what Palpatine is doing? I'm not sure that he would bring her in on that. Yeah. So for all she knows, this clone, he comes to attention when Palpatine shows up, so he's still got his senses about him. So she's worried, look, this guy is clean cut, he's articulate, he's motivated, he seems outwardly to be loyal. If he gets in a room with the Chancellor, it could, you know, something bad could happen to us and to Tyrannus's plan, so I've got to destabilize him a little bit. And of course, the bitter irony here is that was completely unnecessary. It's funny because the fact that she does it, the fact that she thinks she needs to put him off of his game with whatever she gives him, it speaks to her ignorance because she doesn't know, of course, that she doesn't need to worry about Palpatine.
Good point.
And so you have that moment of cruelty and sort of conniving behavior on her part. But the bigger tragedy isn't that she does it. It's that it was unnecessary.
Very, very good. I really like how you phrase that, because it's sort of challenging to try to figure out who is on whose side, who knows how much of what they know. I mean, clearly, this entire arc opened our eyes to how much Dooku knew about Palpatine's ultimate plan, which I found intriguing as well, and how much he knew. And because that isn't really clear in the prequel trilogy, and clearly that Palpatine has his ace in the hole with Anakin Skywalker, obviously. But it just raises a lot of questions. And I think, Eric, that makes sense to me, the fact that maybe it was just more of like some sort of a sedative because she thought he was going to blab some more stuff and try to get people more onto his side, sort of to acquiesce to how he is doing what this inhibitor chip is doing. Let's talk about AZ-3, a very charming... The Clone Wars, one of the things the Clone Wars has done so well, besides fleshing out Anakin and the clones, is taking droids. I know a lot of people really do not like that droid arc in Season 5. I'm going to say that I really found it fascinating for a lot of reasons, a lot of metaphysical reasons. But AZ-3 is a fascinating character. What did he do for you guys as far as, did he enhance your love of this arc a little bit more? What did he do for you?
I kind of thought he played the CP-3O, kind of that role of like he's kind of the
But less annoying
idiot
than 3PO on the
no,
prequels,
yeah.
Let's be honest. Yeah.
But I think he got the same eyes as he did, so kind of gave me that that feeling. Is, I mean, kind of the comedy of the whole thing kind of abrupt. He was almost, it's interesting to me because it was almost, I think it was the second episode where
conspiracy.
Five was in the other room.
Well, when he says droids, I always wanted to have human feelings. I thought that was an incredibly poignant sentence, maybe one of the most powerful in the entire series.
Huh. Yeah. Well,
and then he says, but I don't, and then he runs away.
Yes. Yeah. He was so cut and dry.
Well, it shows that this cold hard logic, it's almost like we have seen clearly throughout the entire Star Wars mythology that with droids, the more human interaction they have, where they're treated like individuals, they become individuals.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful parallel to what's going on with the clones themselves.
Well, I was going to say too is, you know, when they're in that room together, he's bringing up all these ideas of individuality and whatnot, and he talked about their identification numbers. And
I agree.
And Fives brings up kind of like, well, aren't you individualized? He's, no, I'm just a number, and so are you. And AZ-3 kind of realizes, oh, that's interesting that he would think that way. But, you know, like he said, he's cut and dry where he's like, oh, I don't have that stuff, so I'm good to go. So kind of like it's almost like a stair step to where, you know, you see the droids, you see the clones, and you see like everybody else as far as, you know, their emotions and the characters and individuality.
Well, and I think it's so great that Fives is the clone that's doing all this, because his nickname is, I think it's the only one of the main clones we've been introduced to that is based on his number,
yes.
Or at least based on a number that is so recurrent in his designation, right? It's all about that number for him, Fives. And it's not, you know, Echo because he repeats orders all the time, or Heavy because he's the brawny guy with the heavy missile launcher or the big gun. It's Fives, not because of any personality trait, just because this repetition of the number. He's emphasizing the number, even if he's doing it through his nickname. And so you have partly a reflection of his he understands, yes, I have a number. Most of the systems in the Republic, if I were to have a barcode, I would be scanned by this number. But the other part is I'm rebelling against that. And I'm doing it in a way that reflects the number, but also distances me from the things that that would imply. And I think to him, at the beginning of the arc, what it implies, having a number, is being a droid, is being a piece of equipment. By the end of the arc, I don't think he's thinking that way anymore. I think he's seeing the droids as the same thing that he is. And in fundamental ways, they are very, very similar. They have the ability to react to experiences, which is part of what the clones do so brilliantly over battle droids. And the droids we're seeing on the Republic side, especially AZ-3, they have that same ability. AZ-3 violates his programming because he is so captivated by this journey that Fives is on. Fives has convinced him the way that a Jedi was probably convinced Fives back in the day.
And there's just a great little thing going on here. We've got free thinking versus programming, which I found really awesome. How did you both interpret what Count Dooku says? The chip was safeguarded against a trail from rogue Jedi. Sifo Dyas was the only Jedi who knew this. I don't understand why it would be a trail from rogue Jedi. I didn't quite get that. And of course, Dooku, another master of manipulation, how much can he even be trusted?
I mean, I saw it as him saying the army serves the Republic, and so if a Jedi who is in command ever snaps, they need to be able to understand that they have the authority, in fact, the imperative to take him out, which is sort of funny because that is basically what Order 66 is convincing or not convincing, but telling the clones that the Jedi have all snapped. So I thought that was Dooku. I don't know how much he knew and whether he thought he was telling the truth or whether he thought he was telling a lie, but he ended up basically saying something that was very accurate, that this is a safeguard for the Republic that the Jedi can't know about.
And that's probably how he made his little transaction with the Kaminoans as well. But that would be more of a trail towards rogue Jedi, not a trail from rogue Jedi.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yes. And maybe that's just a semantical argument.
I don't know how to interpret
that. Yeah, I found that to be, and I mean, I rewound it probably 5 or 6 times to make sure I had it accurate. And it sure what it sounded like to me.
So you're saying it is from past results or our past experiences?
Absolutely.
From Rogue Jedi. So it's,
yeah, I mean, and he does say it's very rare. I mean, we've seen some examples of that throughout the series anyway. I thought it was interesting. AZ-3, he, for all the other things he does besides adding a little bit of levity to this series, to this arc, and to showing the human side of the droid and bringing out more of Five's humanity, what he actually says is that the tumor is blocking neural impulses from communicating within the brain. So he's basically saying, look, this chip is in here because more than likely, you know, what Tup did, he clearly did not want to do, but this, quote, tumor is what blocks these impulses from coming within the brain. This, to me, that just adds even more to my belief that all this chip does is execute Order 66. It has nothing to do with aggressive behavior. Because let's be honest, if you're a soldier, and Eric, you made some great comparisons earlier when we started talking about this, the more intense and the more combat you've seen, of course, the more likely you are to have an inclination towards stress or to be not necessarily overwhelmed, but to be overcome with particular emotions. Clearly, you have to have a cool head to survive in war, to survive in battle. But I think there's a lot of truth here. AZ-3 really is sort of a voice to the audience to kind of explain what's going on in this beautiful and complicated scenario.
No, I think you're right. I happen to think that the Kaminoans were worried about the Republic soldiers not being obedient enough, and so they put the chip in. But I think it's perfectly explainable if that chip doesn't keep them obedient, if it is purely Order 66. I mean, certainly we don't see much evidence that the chip ends up working.
That's correct. There's just so many beautiful things that we don't really have time to go through in great detail, but all of the nods, you know, to, you know, close the blast doors and the hallway in Fugitive looks a lot like Cloud City, I thought, when Luke is going through to find Vader. And there's a lot of beautiful little poignant moments in that, which, again, I encourage everybody. And now Eric owes me $50 again because, you know, the way you look at a lot of these things that happen in these 4 episodes are really worth people looking at. And I'm going to put a link in our show notes as well. because you really break down a lot of exciting things that happen in this arc. And would you say, Eric, that this is your favorite arc in season six?
If it's not my favorite, it's edged out by the final arc by just the smallest millimeter. I think there's so much here to love, particularly because this is a huge arc, and it's the bigness of it. The scope of it relates to the clones specifically, and to the war, and to the Jedi. It isn't the Force as much, which is the final arc. It is the clones. And given that this series is about the clones, I think having this be such a well-done arc with this particular focus, it was a great use of time, a great use of four episodes.
Agreed. And I think our discussion here is just opening up more ideas and more avenues and more questions, which is, again, why we're continually drawn to the Star Wars saga, because it just there are more questions sometimes than answers, which I, for one, love and applaud. So while we're at it, any last thoughts, gentlemen, on this overall arc, things you loved, things you didn't like as well? And we've covered it pretty well. Just any last-minute things you wanted to say about this?
Well, I know that Eric brought it up, but I thought the clone bar at the end episode was kind of cool. Kind of gave us a little bit of openness to the world they live in, the kind of their off-duty things.
See, I didn't like that at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really? I think I'm sort of more of the Kyle Newman school of thought when it comes. The more they stay away from reality, I don't know that I want to see restaurants besides the cantina and that kind of stuff. I don't know. I just sort of takes the verisimilitude away just a little bit. I mean, overall, it's not bad. It's better than the diner in episode two to me. And I understand what they're doing with the culture and that kind of a thing. But that sort of took me out of it very briefly. I know I'm probably in the minority, and I'm okay with that.
I think you are. But that's okay.
Yeah, and I remember, Eric, you said you liked that part. You thought that was really strong.
I thought it was just a nice indicator of the relationship between the army and the civilians. I mean, a lot of the praise that I hear for the Karen Travis novels comes from the way they explore how the clones feel about civilians, you know, civvies. Yes. And it's not like a grand scale big picture dynamic the way that like the Chosen One and like Order 66 are, but it is something that we don't see a lot of. And I think the portrayal of the droid bar I thought was very economical, or the clone bar was very economical in the sense that it took a moderate amount of time, but it opened up this huge avenue of questions at pretty much every like sequence, every mini sequence in there, from getting in the taxi, talking to the taxi driver, you know, not having money to pay the taxi driver, and then the taxi driver curses at him and they throw their liquor bottles. I mean, everything I just described has embedded in it these relationships between droids and clones and civilians, and what do you know, the structures, right? The army,
sure,
with the population, how they interact. I was so fascinated. And it's, again, it's not big picture. You can't spend a lot of time on it. But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, that's so cool, because this is here. There is this tension between the people who fight the war and the people who don't, and the people who have no idea what's going on, like the taxi driver, and the people who are so embittered by it, like the clones who throw their drinks. So, yes, I enjoyed it. I thought it added a nice little nuance to this story about the clones.
Fair enough.
No, it's not for everybody. If you don't like reality, like that kind of realism, then it's just never going to work for you. That's totally fine.
Right. And I guess it's just sort of, I don't really feel that particularly strongly about it, but it is something I thought, oh, okay, here we go. I think it's whenever I see, I can't help but think of the bar in Coruscant in episode two when Obi-Wan in
the Outlander.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that, and just seeing like these on the screen, oh, look, there's pod races and pit droids are doing things. And I'd
say, it's actually they're all owned by one company, so they're all furnished in the same way.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's a monopoly.
Yeah.
I'm sure Palpatine has something to do with that as well.
The taxation of the trade routes. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me of Blade Runner a little bit, kind of that those scenes and things. So,
yeah, I could see that. Or also the Fifth Element as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I can see that. Well, Eric, we can't possibly have you on Coffee with Kenobi without asking you our five questions that we ask all of our guests. It's great to hear the comparisons to how different people look at the saga. So I'm just going to jump into this. What is your favorite Star Wars movie?
Oh, gosh. You know, all right. I'll just say I think my favorite movie is Episode III. And I know that's heresy to not pick an original trilogy film. I love the original trilogy. But for me, one of the best things about Star Wars for me is the political aspect, how individuals play on human emotions and how the machinations are accomplished. I like the big picture stuff more than the human drama, which is not to say that I don't like the human drama. I'm more captivated by the how we got to where we are aspect of the prequels. And episode 3 was jam-packed with that. So I thought it was fantastic. I thought the Anakin Obi-Wan duel was great. I just found a lot to love there.
That's a great answer. Okay, second question is, who's your favorite Star Wars character?
Well, it would normally be Waru, just because I think, you know, what do you say about Waru? But I'll go with Mace Windu for a more serious answer. I'm one of the few, I get the sense, who really appreciates and likes Mace Windu. I just, you know, part of it is Shatterpoint, which I think opened a lot of new ways of looking at Mace Windu. Even just looking at him in the Clone Wars without Shatterpoint necessarily being the plot, just sort of considering what kind of Jedi he is and his attitude. I mean, clearly he's made a lot of mistakes. I think he's partly responsible for Anakin's fall. But his skepticism about Anakin was warranted. And you can get, I see maybe him as pushing back on Yoda's permitting Obi-Wan to train him. He's always kind of had it out for Anakin, and he turns out to be right.
His insights serve him well.
If only he could have seen that coming.
That's right. Well, and one of my favorite Mace Windu moments is from the original Clone Wars, where he basically spends 10 minutes just taking out a battalion, many, many battalions of battle droids. It's one of the coolest moments for Mace Windu. What is your favorite line of dialogue or film moment?
Well, this goes back to why I picked episode 3. My favorite line of dialogue is toward the end of episode 3, Palpatine has just declared that, you know, there's going to be a new order. And Padme is sitting there watching everybody applaud. And she says, "So this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause." I've sort of loved the sadness that you hear from her, because she loves this institution and she has this acute feeling that something terrible is happening, but she can't stop it. And it's for the benefit of the audience, really. It's a comment on how those processes play out and how you have to be vigilant. And she did her best. I have a lot of criticisms of Padme, but that's not one of them. She is very devoted to the Republic, and I felt acutely her sense of loss in that moment.
Do you see that as kind of meta, that particular line? One of Lucas's rare moments where he really isn't, he's not breaking the fourth wall, so to speak, but it's very meta.
Do you mean in the sense of trying to tell us a real world message about the contemporary events?
Extremely. Extremely.
Yeah, so. I mean, I suppose this is 2005, that, you know, a lot of things were going on in the world that, mm-hmm. you know, generate a lot of criticism. I would say more, if he did mean that, I can't imagine that he shoehorned this in for that purpose. I think that line works so well just in the context of the film that I have to assume that that was part of his plan for how to show this particular conflict, and that if it's an allegory or a warning to us, that it was purely accidental.
Well, I completely agree with you on that. I think that it fits the story beautifully and perfectly. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Star Wars Heresies book. Have you read that by Paul McDonald?
No, I haven't, no.
I think you'd love it. I think of that when you mention allegories, because he talks about the notion when Anakin kills all the younglings in the Jedi Temple, that's really more of an allegory of him ending his innocence. And the only reason I even bring that up to interrupt our five questions is because I just think that you particularly would really, really like that book. I'd love to talk to you about it after you read it, actually.
Yeah, he's contributed, Paul has, to TFN. He's had some... When we did our listener feedback series on ForceCast.net way back in the day, he was one of the best contributors as far as having these well-thought-out posts. So I will definitely check it out.
Yeah, do.
Well, speaking of things you can go and pick up or collect... what is your favorite collectible that you own, if you collect?
Ooh, I collect books. I don't collect action figures or statues or anything that's pricier. I'm looking at my books right now. I don't know if I have one particular book that stands out above the others. I have been lucky enough to meet several authors and get them to sign the book and discuss the book with me. So I guess maybe the autographed copies of some of the books that I have, where I can sort of point to discussions that I've had, brief ones with the authors. That's kind of something where when I see it, it triggers that memory of interacting with somebody who gave me something that I thought was really special.
Definitely. Might I ask, what book are you looking forward to that's coming out this year or next year?
Well, I'm looking forward to all four, but I have to say I'm most excited for Tarkin. You know, a New Dawn. I mean, John Jackson Miller with Kenobi has written one of the best Star Wars books of all time. So I'm excited for A New Dawn. I'm very, very much looking forward to seeing how they tie it into Rebels. I don't know how much I'm going to enjoy Heir to the Jedi because I don't know anything about Kevin Hearn, but first person is not my thing. I've enjoyed Paul Kemp's books. So the Lords of the Sith should be interesting. But for me, again, it comes back to what I said about liking the political machinations, the bureaucratic wrangling, and how that can be made very exciting. I think Tarkin is probably going to be the one for me.
Well, you've got James Luceno. He's amazing. He's perfect for that. I agree. I'm at least excited about the buddy cop Darth Vader Emperor one. I'm really excited about that, but we'll see. Maybe it'll be awesome. So, but Eric, you're the first guy that ever got us off topic on our five questions. Look at you.
Well, I'm happy to be the first.
Attaboy. So, what particular messages or themes about the Star Wars saga resonate or speak to you?
Again, I bring it back to political. As far as I think with the prequels, in part, George had a very specific mission, which is to show us how we got to the Empire. But in part, I think one of his goals was to show the downfall of a society through the lack of vigilance. And I think it's important in a democratic society to be wary of messages that you hear, to be skeptical, to be critical. And I've always found that aspect of the prequel so great because it shows us how naivete and ignorance and apathy are the best tools that any evildoer can ever hope for. It does not matter how many ships you have. It does not matter how much force power you have, how many midichlorians you have. If you can count on the apathy of the public and the eagerness to locate a scapegoat, you can count on the kind of massive changes in government that will facilitate other plans that you have. And that is, to me, the message of the prequels. The originals, I think it's sort of rebalancing. It is, I mean, the Rebel Alliance, what is that if not a giant criticism of the government? And so if you look at it chronologically, obviously this isn't necessarily the way that – this is not how he did it. It is the way that he might have planned it. But you have the apathy and then the downfall of democracy. And then in the next trilogy, you have – criticism and attention and the rallying cry of the rebels trying to put a spotlight on cruelty, pushing back against the cruelty and saying, no, we're going to shine a spotlight on this. You can't hide anymore. You can't lie to the people about what you're using the Death Star for. Obviously, that's the chronological view, not the production view. But that, to me, is an important message in Star Wars. It is, you know, pay attention. If you don't have force powers, you can still be very important when there's a large enough group of you. And that's what democracy is all about.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why Eric Keller is going to be one awesome journalist. I love that. Was great.
Well, that was awesome.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's true, and I love that. And this is also why we had Eric join us for our very first episode of A Cup of Clone Wars. Well, Eric, before we let you go, looks like your coffee's almost empty. Where can our friends and our listeners find you? I'm sure they already know, but...
Well, I'm not really on the internet. I tend to stick to mail. If you want to send me a letter, I have a P.O. box.
With Waru
stamps. Send me a
stamps.
Telegram. Yeah, with Waru stamps, exactly. You can follow me on Twitter, at Eric Geller, E-R-I-C-G-E-L-L-E-R. And I tweet Star Wars politics. If you're interested in the nexus of those two things, I think you will hopefully enjoy what I have to say. And anytime there's a new Forcecast episode, you can find that at Forcecast.net. And, of course, the Force.net for all the latest news that I try to keep on top of to say, hey, here's what's happening in the world of Star Wars.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for being again with us on our premiere episode. It was wonderful to have you on. We love having like-minded individuals who aren't afraid to kind of dig into the critical thinking aspects of Star Wars and the Clone Wars. So we certainly look forward to having you on in the future when we do our Rebels reactions.
Well, thank you both. It's been so much fun. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate you coming on.
Chewie, get us out of here!
If you would like to respond to our question of the show, have a comment, or just want to say hello, send us an email or MP3 at feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or if you have a specific question or comment for either of us individually, email us at danz@coffeewithkenobi.com or coreyc@coffeewithkenobi.com or visit us at coffeewithkenobi.com and click on the Contact Us section or comment on one of the stories featured on the site. If you enjoy the show, please write a review in iTunes. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/coffeewithkenobi, as well as keep up to date on our Twitter feed at twitter.com/coffeewithkenobi. You can also find us on Tumblr at coffeewithkenobi.tumblr.com. If you enjoy the jazz music, download the album Eye to Eye by Steve Torok on iTunes.
Give the evacuation code signal.
This podcast is not endorsed by the Walt Disney Company or Lucasfilm Limited. It is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names, sounds, and any other Star Wars-related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Disney and their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Coffee with Kenobi unless otherwise indicated.